Since the draft in late June, and here we are on July 10, the last 3 weeks have been extremely busy for this team. The team looks significantly different from the last time that we saw them on the ice. What have you made of the last 3 weeks or so in the complete and utter roster overhaul we've seen?
To be honest, I was looking at the roster, and half the time I look at the roster and the new names, I have to scratch my head and remind myself that, you know, James Neal's a Calgary Flame, Derek Ryan's a Calgary Flame. I'm still wrapping my head around the fact that Noah Hanifin and Elias Lindholm are Calgary Flames. So it's going to be a very, very new group when they hit the ice on October 3rd to open the regular season. And I think a lot of people were probably thinking they needed to be a different group after the way last season ended.
Are they better or are they just different?
I think that I know that Dougie Hamilton deletion caused a lot of hand-wringing, and I think, you know, anytime you take a player with his skill set out of the lineup, there's going to be some judgment made. But I think the thing that they did that I think was very smart was Brad Treliving gave himself and his coaching staff a lot more options. If you look at the roster last year, who's going to play in the top line? Well, you pretty much knew. And who's going to play in the second line? The 3M line is basically set in stone, partially because Glenn Gulson didn't like line shuffling and partially because, well, who else could do that job? And you can make the same case for the bottom six group where there's a couple names on the farm that could really potentially push for jobs. But for the most part, there were the same seven or eight guys that were there all year. And did they deserve to be there? Well, you know, they were fine, but fine is what got them 11 points out of a playoff spot. So I think the thing that I was really impressed with was just Treliving's ability to sort of give his coaching staff options. You know, I think Brad Treliving joked on July 1 that, you know, while they're acquiring players, they just kept going through the lineups every 10 minutes and scratching out names and just reshuffling things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the kind of thing that they weren't able to do at all last year because guys were just too set in stone and, you know, you couldn't really shuffle some people around to get different looks because guys simply didn't have the versatility in their games to be able to do that.
Yeah, at forward specifically, you're bang on. I'm with you there. Like they're in a situation now where if you're Bill Peters and that coaching staff, the options that you have for constructing your lines, using your lines, and shuffling them up if things don't work, completely different and far better. And it also makes for way more competition as you get into your bottom six. Like, they see Austin Zarnik right now as a full-time NHLer next year. It's up to him to prove that. But now if you're Garnet Hathaway or Troy Brower or Curtis Lazar, you're now competing with Austin Zarnik for a full-time spot. And Mark Jankowski, well, now all of a sudden you're competing with Derek Ryan for a third-line center spot. And the bottom six competition and who might be the odd man out in that conversation, that's where I think the biggest impact is going to be felt, is that just up and down the lineup, they're still going to be good in their top six. They're still going to have scoring from Monahan and Gaudreau and Tkachuk, and Backlund's still going to be a really good two-way center, all that type of stuff. But it's going up and down the lineup, I feel anyway, is where they really are going to have a bigger advantage than they have in a long, long time.
And you and I have watched enough of this team over the last few years to sort of see, particularly under Gulladson, that you could sort of tell how the game was going to go based on the way the other team played them in the first period. And they had obviously a lot of talented players in the lineup, but, you know, let's be honest, Michael Backlund is a player who has a very specific skill set, and he's very good at that, but you can argue there's not a ton of versatility in parts of his game. But say, you know, you're in a certain game situation, maybe you can shuffle him down to 3C for a couple periods in order to get Lindholm more faceoffs and Monahan more faceoffs. Maybe it's a situation where, you know, Monahan's getting, you know, really hammered on faceoffs. You can, you know, shuffle somebody up there like a Lindholm for a couple shifts to sort of get things going. And before it was, well, who are the Flame centers? Well, it's four left shot guys. How are they doing? They're doing how they're going to do because they don't really have many right-hand options. Now they probably have about three or four interesting right-hand options. So, you know, if a lefty face-off guy is just, you know, absolutely, you know, not getting anything done, they can shuffle things around. And I think there's going to be a bit more urgency in everyone's games because, you know, I was joking with some of the guys at Dev Camp, outside of perhaps Mike Smith, Mark Giordano, Johnny Gaudreau and Sean Monahan, I don't think anyone on this team has a set in stone role. As in, you know, if you're Backlund, are you the second line center? Probably to start, But if Backlund doesn't get the job done, they have the ability to shuffle a Derek Ryan or an Elias Lindholm there. Who's the first line right wing? Probably James Neal. But if James Neal isn't a good fit on that line, they have the ability to shuffle guys around. Maybe even someone like Austin Zarnik, depending on how he fits into the team, could spot in there. Who are the 13 and 14 forwards going to be? It could be someone from the farm who's hungry. It could be Troy Brouwer. And I think having that kind of an atmosphere where outside of a handful of guys, no one really has a strictly defined role will really keep people on their toes in a way they weren't on the toes last year.
What about on the back end? I think that the competition and the way things slot up front, I think you're feeling really comfortable about if you're a Flames fan. But with Dougie Hamilton leaving, and he played some of the toughest minutes in the NHL, was on one of the best pairings in the NHL with Mark Giordano, he leaves. TJ Brody, theoretically, at least for now, is the guy earmarked to move into that spot on the other side with Gio. Where are you in terms of your comfort level on the way this blue line is going to slot next year?
I'll just say this right up front. If TJ Brody looks anything like he did 3-4 years ago with Mark Giordano, I think Giordano needs to be a finalist for the Norris Trophy, because I think Brody has just looked uncomfortable for a lot of the last 2 years. And part of that was sort of getting used to new situations, new line mates, new pairings. But a lot of it was Mark Giordano is really good. And Mark Giordano has the ability to potentially make guys that are pretty good look elite, and guys that are sort of borderline look like NHLers. And I think if they're close and if they click right away, and we should probably find out during the first couple of games of training camp if the chemistry is still there, I think that could really, really help out. Beyond that, I'm a big fan of Noah Hanifin. I'm not sure if he's going to be as good as Dougie Hamilton is right now or will be, but I think they brought in a coach in Ryan Huska in the offseason who has a reputation as being, for lack of a better term, a defenseman whisperer. He's a guy that in Kelowna just brought defensemen along. The guys he had in Stockton the last couple of years have really come along nicely and provided the NHL team with a lot of depth. So I think the Hanifin acquisition is a big bet on Ryan Huska's ability to bring defensemen along, and I think a big bet on Travis Hamonic's ability to mentor guys, because Hamonic was brought in and he wasn't really sold as an offensive guy, but the idea would be he's a guy will give you what you're going to get every game. He's very consistent. He plays more of a shutdown game. And I think if he can help bring along Hanifin's defensive game in terms of helping him figure things out positionally in the defensive end, and if someone like Huska can keep building up Hanifin's confidence with the puck, I think suddenly you have two defensive pairings that can really get things going for you. Mm-hmm. And then, you have a third pairing where, I don't know if anyone has a safe job there. I think Michael Stone is probably, at least right now, if he's in the Flames organization, he's your right side on the third pairing. But if I'm Brett Kulak, I might be a bit nervous after seeing how good Yusuf Alamaki looked in dev camp. There's a potential for someone like Oliver Shillington to make a push. We saw Michael Stone play on the left side a bit last year when injuries hit. Generally speaking, Bill Peters is a lefty-righty guy like a lot of head coaches are. But, if Rasmus Anderson looks miles ahead of anyone else, maybe you think about shuffling guys to the side because some of them have that ability to play either side. So I think that third pairing is what needed to be upgraded in the offseason. And I think in the aggregate, between guys making a push, between guys improving, and honestly just between guys being slotted in a more opportune way, I think that might help.
Ryan Pike's with us from FlamesNation.ca as we continue on the big show this afternoon. It's funny, you mentioned guys like Lindholm and Hanifin wrote over at FlamesNation.ca yesterday about what their potential contracts could look like. Lindholm is arbitration eligible. He's filed for arbitration. Hanifin is not, but both guys are pending restricted free agents. At least for me, my feel is there's a little bit of a dichotomy there. And then on the one side, I look at Lindholm and say he is a really good fit for a longer term kind of 6-year deal, whereas Hanifin seems a little bit more in line for a bridge contract. That seems a little bit more realistic just in terms of ages, positions, ceilings, and proven track record. I think Lindholm seems like a far safer bet to go long term, whereas Hanifin, there's a little bit more risk involved if you're going 6, 7, or 8 years. But where are you on that? Do you think there's a difference in the way they should be looking at this, or is long term good for both?
I'm pretty much with you on that. I think for Lindholm, there's two things. I think he's a lot closer to what he's going to be than it is for Noah Hanifin. So if you're Elias Lindholm's representation, I don't think you can really go and say, will he become, John Tavares overnight? Well, probably not, and he probably won't in the next few years. But, he's going to be a top six player on a team that has intentions of being a good team. So maybe his offense will take a bit of an uptick, but it's not like he's going to make, big leaps and bounds. But, defensemen mature later, and they mature differently. And when you're 21 years old, you've already played three seasons in the NHL, I don't think it's a safe bet what he's going to be in the case of Noah Hanifin. So, I think the fact that he has so much upside and so much untapped potential is a risk on both ends, because if you're his representation, you wouldn't want to sign for more than a couple of years, because between 21 and 23 or 21 and 24, yeah, he could become a completely different player. Especially if you consider that, long-term, if you're a succession planner like Brad Tree Living usually is, Mark Giordano is in his 30s. He's starting to creep into his mid-30s. So in an ideal world, you can bring along a Noah Hanifin and have him being mentored by, Giordano and Hamonic, and become someone that maybe could take the reins of his role in certain years. So I think for Lindholm, between how deep the team is at center and on the wing, I don't think there's really a lot of upward momentum for him. And I think he probably wants to cash in long-term and just get them something solid done long-term. But if you're someone like Hanifin, you want to bet on yourself and say, maybe in a couple of years, he'll be a $6 million player. He's definitely not there yet, but I think you want to give him the ability to grow there.
The interesting thing about the Hanifin negotiation is Brad Tree Living told us on Friday that, he's looking for, that the team's looking for a long-term deal with Lindholm, and the player seems to be on that same kind of wavelength. But what's interesting on the Hanifin front is that the player side of things, because even when fans are like, well, give him the Roman Josi deal and go long and get the cap hit down and have a little bit of long-term security. But with Hanifin, why wouldn't he want to bet on himself? Why wouldn't he and his camp want to go 2 or 3 years? Yeah, it may not be for as much money as he could potentially get if it was long-term, but it sets himself up for a much bigger contract if he continues to take incremental steps, which he has in all 3 years of his NHL career. That's why this negotiation is a little bit different. Because I don't know, even if the Flames are looking for a long-term deal, I don't know if the player's side would be on the same page.
Exactly. And if you're looking from a Flames perspective, anyone who goes to NHL numbers or cap friendly can sort of see how the Flames are set up for the next couple of years, especially as we're most likely headed toward an expansion draft in 2020. And they have some big contracts coming off the books in 2 years. And so if you're just a cap planner, maybe the sales pitch to Hanifin is, hey, let's just bridge you right now just for logistical reasons. And then in 2 years, let's see what kind of money we have to work with.
We'll see. We'll see what ends up happening. And on the Lindholm front, it feels like 6 years is a good sweet spot for his contract, just because you're buying 4 years of UFA time. He's UFA eligible in 2 years, so you'd be buying 4 years, which is reasonable. If you go 7 or 8, you're buying 5 and 6 UFA years, which is going to jack that cap hit up even more. I wonder if 6 isn't the sweet spot for a guy like that. It's long-term, but the AAV can still be kept pretty reasonable, I'd think.
I think 6 has tended to be Tree Living's lucky number. When pretty much everyone he signed long-term as a Flames general manager, starting with Mark Giordano, has been a 6-year deal. It's long enough that you feel like you have long-term sustainability. It's short enough that you're not going to get scared by going 7 or 8 years on a guy that, depending on their age, might peak really early. Realistically, I don't think there's a bad bet in terms of Lindholm, but, you probably want to lock him in for a while just so you can figure out what pieces you have around him.
Ryan Pike's with us from FlamesNation.ca as we continue talking some Flames hockey on the big show this afternoon. Final place to go, development camp, all wrapped up, 3 days on the ice, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, including the scrimmage Sunday at Winsport. Your takeaways, just from before we get into specifics, just your overall takeaways of the on-ice sessions this year's camp and what stood out to you from development camp this year?
Well, I know there's a tendency to make broad declarations that everyone's making the team after development camp because it's July and we're all very, very hungry for hockey. I'll stop just short of doing that. But I thought compared to other years, it was sort of a much greener group. There were some guys who were eligible to go. Rasmus Anderson was eligible, Andrew Mangiapane, Ryan Blomberg, those kind of guys. The guys with NHL experience outside of Spencer Fu were not here. which I think made for a bit more of a competitive camp because, you know, there was basically just a bunch of hungry guys there. I really thought that the guys that we're all thinking, hey, will he be close? The Dylan Dubés, Valimakis, and Spencer Foos, they all looked as we hoped they would. They all looked pretty close. But I was pretty impressed by some of the walk-on guys. I thought, you know, the quality of guys they brought in was probably a little bit higher than it was in prior years. And I just think that the gap between the high-end guys in the camp and the lower-end guys was a lot closer than it's ever been in the last few years.
Anybody specifically, outside of the big names, anybody specifically that jumped off the page to you?
I really liked Bobby McMahon. He really impressed me in that scrimmage. It's hard the first couple of days of death camp because, you know, a lot of it is just guys doing drills and, you know, people ask me, oh, how does this guy look? I'm like, well, you know, he hit the net a lot. You know, it's easy to do because it's not really a live fire exercise. But in the scrimmage, McMahon really impressed me with his speed. There was a couple chances where, you know, he was trying to get around a defenseman and then some skaters just have that extra gear where if they go, I'm getting past this guy, they can do it. Not a lot of guys do. And McMahon, on three or four occasions, just decided, okay, I'm going to turn my speed up and cut to the inside. And every time he did it. And it was really impressive because I'm like, okay, at this point, he's just showing off. So he was pretty impressive. Some of the draftees this year, I know any year when you have, you know, no pick in the first three rounds and the earliest pick you have is 105th, it's easy for fans to be sort of a little bit negative or, you know, down on the draft class. But the guys they got in the first few rounds were pretty impressive. Their seventh round draft pick, I'm going to butcher his name, Dmitry Zavgorodny. He's a Russian kid.
I go with Zavgorodny. I have no idea if I'm correct, but that's how I've been saying it.
Yeah, and when I interviewed him, I didn't ask him how to pronounce his last name. I probably should. But he really impressed me just in terms of, you know, he reminds me, I think I saw the comparison on Twitter. I didn't hate it. He seems like just a right-handed Mangiapane in that he sort of has that same sort of stout build. He's not a tall kid, you know, with skates on. He's, you know, barely taller than I am, and I'm, you know, just under 6 feet. But he's just a thick kid. He's got a good center of gravity, and, you know, he was, you know, playing with the puck in the scrimmage in the corners and no one could get away from him. And he was just always in the right spot. And it's hard, you know, especially for a guy who's been in North America for all of 1 year, you know, he seemed to really know where to be on the ice. And, you know, I think, you know, it's a seven round pick. So the ceiling's, you know, a little bit different than from other players, but, you know, the Flames have had success with 6 and 7 round picks in the last few years. So he could be another one of them.
You mentioned Valimaki a little earlier, and I know it's only development camp. I know that you can't put everything into what you see in July, but man, just his maturity. I talked to him on Friday, watching him on the ice, knowing what he has done at high-level competitions at the World Juniors and playing in the Western League. He's going to be playing pro hockey this year. We know that, but I wonder how much pro hockey is spent in the National Hockey League, and I wonder how much of it, I wonder if we're talking about significant NHL time for a player like this, because he looks like he is truly knocking on the door right now.
If he doesn't make the team out of camp, he kind of strikes me as someone like Jankowski did last year, where when Jankowski came into the main camp, you could just sort of see with his body language, with the way he played on the ice, and where even the way he did drills and practices, that, okay, I'm done with the AHL. I'm tired of the AHL. I need to be here. And Valimaki sort of carried himself the same kind of way at Dev Camp. Granted, like you said, it's just Dev Camp. But I think, like Jankowski was one of the guys that had, you know, him and Dylan Dubé were the two best rookies in main camp last year. And Dubé, there's obviously a lot of weird CBA reasons why you couldn't put a 19-year-old kid right in the NHL. But with Valimaki, you know, he's in a different position than Dubé was last year. And I think he's very similar to how Jankowski was last year, where if he doesn't make the team out of camp, I think they're going to have to make some room pretty quick, because he's one of those guys that just strikes me as the type that's just going to light up the AHL if he's there in October.
You mentioned Dubé. He and Spencer Foo, two of the other guys that, you know, are seemingly near the top of the list and knocking on the door loudest. Final question. Foo and Dubé, factors in camp? Are we talking about them potentially fighting for spots in September and October, or is that a later on in the season conversation?
I think those two gentlemen and Mr. Valimaki, I think they're going to make decisions very, very difficult for Bradshaw Living and his hockey ops group. I think those three, and you know, for the forward group, Dubé and Fu in particular, I think they're going to be amongst, if they don't make the team, they're probably going to be the last guy sent down, because you know, everything I've seen from them between last season and dev camp, and you know, how they seem to be prepared, I think they're going to make life difficult for a lot of veterans.
Good stuff, buddy. Appreciate the time, Ryan. You have yourself a wonderful rest of your week. Happy stampeding.
You as well.